Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 2:48 p.m. that is Central Time, and today is March 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day to anyone who's celebrating it. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, it's not every week that gold jumps like it has this week. So we've had a very emphatic rebound from the $1,800 area and the region of the 200-day moving average, and it's coming back into the region of the peaks from back in 2020 and then early in 2022. So this has been a more than 2-year process of ranging. And now the big question is it ready to break out and run from here? And I think we're going to find out next week. Now, of course, we're also going to have a Fed meeting next week. And I think a lot of the discussion that is relevant at present is going to center around what's the outlook for interest rates and monetary accommodation. So then it really does behoove us to think about these particular problems, and I think that's what I'll spend the majority of talking in this broadcast about, because it means that there could be a big move in gold. There could be a major support for emerging markets. There could be the potential that the Nasdaq is unlikely to generate the kind of outsized performance that it has done over the last decade. It could also mean the end of the bond bull market, and arguably that's already happened. The other side of it is that maybe this is just another iteration of the trend that's been underway since 2008, and maybe it is a medium-term correction and not a major top or secular bear market beginning. So there's certainly lots of questions, and I think that just by looking at some of these longer-term charts, we might be able to come up with some kind of answer, or at least a way of thinking about markets that is offering some kind of positioning that would benefit from what happens regardless. I think that's also why I think gold is giving us a pretty significant signal here. And the more back history we look at, then the greater the outlook is that this is a or the end or coming towards the end of a 12-year range. And if that is the case, then we can anticipate that when gold breaks on the upside, it is going to rally and do so in a really significant fashion, because ranges are explosions waiting to happen. And the primary reason that people like gold, it might be shiny and it might warm up in your hand when you hold it, and it might not be anyone else's liability. But the most important thing is that when gold rallies, it really rallies hard. And we have lots of examples of that. More often than not, it does not much of anything. But when it breaks out, it rallies hard. And there are multiple occasions when it goes sideways for a year or 2 years or even 3 years, but when it breaks out, it rallies hard. So now we're coming up towards this $2,000 level. If it breaks out from here, well, there's a good chance it'll be at 3,000 before very long. And then we could be moving into another lengthy period of not doing much of anything. So I think we're at a really rather interesting point here. Now, something that I've been very keenly aware of is that the more back history we look at, and I think we'll get the best result if we simply try and look at this on daily data, but then going back about 40 years, because then we'll get the daily peaks from 1980 into this chart, because the monthly tends to excise them. What we can very clearly see then is that we had an exaggerated peak for the price of gold adjusted for purchasing power parity in 1980. And prices really went haywire, and they got up to almost Well, just about $171 on a purchasing power parity basis. And today they're currently at 219 and firming. So I think that it is at the most likely scenario is that before the big bull market in gold ends, it's going to be well in excess of the purchasing power parity peak from back in 1980. But I think $370 is probably about right for where we could anticipate a big breakout to peak out at. And then we could move into a lengthy period of consolidation again. So this obviously then begs the question, why is gold so strong this week? Well, I think there are two important points. The first is that the dollar is rolling over. And the second is that investors are beginning to price in the potential that interest rates aren't going to rise any further, and that instead they might actually start to come back down. The times when gold does best are generally when it is appreciating in all currencies. So it popped on the upside versus the euro and here today. So this is a new closing high for gold against the euro. And then also when we look at it versus the pound, we've had a very clear breakout to new all-time highs. So this is certainly not just a US dollar phenomenon, but rather we're seeing that gold is breaking higher in lots of currencies, and most particularly among the quasi-reserve currencies. So against the yen, it's also breaking on the upside. So this is the completion of a rather lengthy range overall. Now, let's then think about how's it doing versus what might be considered stronger currencies, like the renminbi. And we have a really significant breakout in here today. So it looks increasingly likely that what we're seeing here is a flight into a hard asset. Now, why would we have such demand for a hard asset that is no one else's liability? Well, it's because we know what's happening in the banking sector. So, banks are rolling over, and the S&P 500 Banks Index declined again in here today. So, last weekend, we had the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, the FDIC coming together saying, right, we're going to backstop all deposits. There aren't going to be limits on deposits any longer, and the federal government will step in and ensure that everyone is made whole. Now, there's a lot of there's a lot of grumbling going on about the fact that the governor of California's vineyards had loans at that bank, at Silicon Valley Bank, or that Oprah Winfrey had the majority of her assets tied up at Silicon Valley Bank. That's another rumor going around. So there's certainly a lot of brewing discontent that there's money being poured into the banking sector at exactly the same time that there was a major chemical spill in the middle of the USA, and there was no federal money donated to the people who were affected by it. So there's definitely people making political capital out of this rescue, but the reality is that bond yields have gone up a lot, and that means that there's about $600 billion in losses that are being excised from bank balance sheets, or I guess more likely priced into bank balance sheets right now. But let's just pay attention to the fact that the S&P 500 Banks Index took out its 2007 peak in 2021 and then failed. So now it's coming back down, and it's doing so in a really rather dynamic fashion. Now, the big problem here is not that suddenly they were massively overlevered, or that an asset class that they had been selling into has suddenly collapsed. Although obviously we've had a big setback in the more speculative portion of the market, most banks did not have a big position in a lot of startups. But they were told that they do have to own Tier 1 capital. And let's not forget that Basel III regulations, they basically said that the banks have to hold government bonds. And regulators say that government bonds are risk-free and that you are abiding by your fiduciary responsibility if you tell your clients that they should own bonds. And insurance companies have to own bonds. And then lots of individual investors were holding bonds. And then governments decided that they were going to massively increase the quantity of bonds outstanding. And we should just bear in mind that we've had a 40-year bull market in bonds. And one of the defining characteristics of at the end of a major bull market is a huge increase in supply. And it really does come back to one of the primary topics in the first half of day one of the chart seminar, which is that a range or a breakout from a range changes the perception of what is likely or how the perception of how bullish or bearish a market is. But a long trend changes the fundamentals. So when a trend has been going on for a long time, then there's a natural incentive for anyone who has the ability to increase the supply of whatever the asset is to benefit from the highly inflated prices. And in 2021, there were almost $18 trillion of bonds with negative yields. So there was an incredible incentive to just print as much debt as possible to increase the supply of bonds because there were ready buyers who basically had no alternative because there was this deflationary doom loop, and people were worried about more about deflation than inflation. And that now has been turned on its head. So there were lots of people who were buying bonds in 2018, 19, 2020, 2021, and they're all sitting on losses right now. So the banking sector is pulling back as a result of that. Now, it doesn't matter that deposits are being backstopped because they're still sitting with these mark-to-market losses. So the only way that this problem is going to be contained is if bond yields come back down, or if governments wade in and give the money to the banks to make them whole. I guess central banks could do that. And the classic way to bail out a banking sector is to create a very wide positive yield curve. So the fundamental basic way of making money as a banker is you borrow short term and you lend long term. And at the moment, that's not working because we have an inverted yield curve. But that yield curve is starting to rally. So it's up 14 basis points in here today. And it has been quite choppy over this week. And I don't think people really realize that the lows are very likely in, and the market right now is pricing in the potential that we are at the top of the interest rate hiking cycle. And then that is also going to favor gold. So this chart is the constant maturity 10-year yield, and it's up to about 134 basis points, and that's the highest level it's been at since really 2010. But how much further can this go on the upside if bond yields are going to start coming back down? And this has been a significant headwind to gold over the course of the last year. So even though the dollar was weaker, The negative real interest rate environment that gold really thrives in, well, it really does best when this chart is going down. So this period between 2008 and 2011, that was really positive for gold. And this period between 2018 and 2021 was also very positive for gold. The fact that gold is doing well right now is pricing in the potential that this index is about to roll over, and that we are going to go from positive real rates into negative real rates again. So let's then go back and think about this yield curve spread. So we can then think about, well, what has to happen here? And there are three phases that generally coincide with an inverted yield curve. And we can really look at a lot of back history here. We can go back 50 years. And what we have lots of examples of is we get an initial inversion, and then markets continue higher. And we had a wobbly kind of environment at the initial inversion. But all the way through 2022, stock markets went down instead of up. And usually, what we have is that markets go up during the initial inversion because investors are generally relieved that the central bank is acting against inflationary pressures. And then it's only when the fact that they have been acting against inflationary pressures and that stress starts to be exhibited within the market, that they start to worry about the fact that maybe the Fed and the predictive power of the yield curve is uniquely predictive for the US economy. It's not nearly as predictive as for other markets, although the logic is the same. You don't generally tend to have the same impact on the economy. And I don't know why that is, but I suspect that it has to do with the dollar and the size of the US economy. And generally, when the US has, well, I guess we've talked for decades about the leash effect. And when the USA catches a cold, it does have knock-on effects elsewhere. But we're now at the stage where investors are worried that the Fed has gone too far already. And that generally coincides with the peak of the interest rate hiking cycle. So I suspect the Federal Reserve will raise rates again next week. And they'll probably go for 25 basis points. But subsequently, they are likely to hold. And then after that, they're going to cut. And that is what the bond market is beginning to price in. So the yield curve spread is now starting to rally. It has rallied enough to break the sequence of lower rally highs. It is right in the region of the 200-day moving average. Now we've had a good size rebound in stock markets because investors are looking at the history of the last decade, where we went from a very wide yield curve all the way down to a negative yield curve. And the most negative the yield curve has been since the 1980s, which of course was the peak of the hiking cycle last time around during a sharply inflationary problem. So now the bigger question here is how much are they going to cut interest rates? Now, this is going to come, I think, front and center when we think about the size of the Fed's balance sheet. So there are two potential outcomes here. We know that the Fed took $625 billion out of circulation, and this week they added back in just about $300 billion, so about half. And what that is suggesting is that we've seen a significant trough in the size of the Fed's balance sheet, and that it's quite likely that the process of quantitative tightening has run its course. So what this also very clearly helps to highlight is that asset prices and the broader economy are totally addicted to liquidity. And even reducing the size of the balance sheet from 9 trillion to about 9 or 8.25 trillion has been enough to cause a very significant problem within the banking sector. And we also know what's happened in the past, that whenever they've tried to reduce the size of the balance sheet, then it starts to go up, and then subsequently it accelerates higher. And the variable and long lag in monetary tightening eventually shows up in the economy. Recessions take hold, and then central banks are forced to act. And since 2008, every time there has been economic weakness, they've doubled the size of the balance sheet. So they doubled it in during the pandemic. Now we're looking at the banking sector coming under stress and significant losses being felt because of the big run-up in yields. And then what we're also starting to see now is that leveraged loans are beginning to roll over. Now, we can look at this in two ways. There's a Credit Suisse index which gives us the total return on their index, and it has just rolled over this week. Then if we look at the Morningstar indices, well, here we have their total return index. So a different basket of loans is also now beginning to roll over, but that's total return. When we then look at the just the bald price, well, it helps to highlight how much yield contributes to total return, because on a price basis, it is distributing below the 200-day moving average. And this looks like a market that is seriously susceptible to additional weakness. So then the high yield sector and the high yield spreads have popped back on the upside, are back above the 500 basis point level. Now, this chart is not updated through the day, so it's yesterday's close is what we're looking at right now. But I think the more important point is the more back history we look at, then the greater the evidence is when high yield spreads pop above the 500 basis point level. That's usually the onset or the beginning of strife in the wider economy. So it was a comfort for the bulls that high yield spreads were contracting in the early part of this year, but they have obviously popped back up again in here this week. And the more risky portion of the market is likely to experience stress. At the bare minimum, the fact that banks are sitting on a difficult environment means that they're going to be less enthusiastic about providing credit. And we're already in a negative real interest rate environment, and banks are liquidity providers. So when banks are rolling over, then that means that their underperformance siphons liquidity out of the global market. And it's not like we've had the we've had an environment where there's been money that's increasing. Now, there's a lot of liquidity has been floating around, but money supply growth is negative for the first time. So the Federal Reserve has been contracting the total quantity of cash. And what that is, just in an absolute terms, it means that it is just beginning to contract. Now, this has not been updated since the end of January. So there's the strong likelihood that the quantity of cash that was injected into the economy in 2020 and has subsequently gone back to trend is likely to contract. And we're at this point where a lot of that liquidity is now being felt in the wider economy. So they have a choice now. They are either going to continue raising rates, and we could, I think about that as the UK solution. So the UK had its pension issue in September and October of last year. They flooded the market with liquidity, and I guess it's not actually true that they did not flood the market with liquidity. They injected vast quantities of liquidity into the pension system, and that helped to support gilt prices, and yields came down a bit. And then they were allowed to, well, they were able to make their mark-to-market margin calls, and the problem was contained. And then the Bank of England continued to raise rates. And since then, they've raised rates by 200 basis points, which is effectively a double. So, because the Federal Reserve increased the size of the balance sheet and then basically gave a blanket ban to the or a blanket guarantee to the entire deposit sector, that's a much bigger form of assistance. And now the big question is, are they going to be able to continue to curtail inflationary pressures by raising rates? Arguably, we might start to see some of the commodity-led inflation beginning to roll over. So oil prices have broken downwards in here this week and done so in really quite a dynamic manner. Now, it's a very volatile price series. So the times when it goes sideways in an inert fashion, they generally suggest that when the breakout comes, it's going to be dynamic. That's what's happened this week, and therefore we give the benefit of the doubt to the downside. I suspect that it is more likely than not we're going to come back down into a 60 and handle. Now, when I think about a 60 handle, I'm not thinking about 69, I'm thinking more about 60. But because we've had the big breakdown, then some of that inflationary pressure is going to moderate. Then, because natural gas prices have already collapsed and were weaker again in here today, well, that has not yet filtered down into the prices that utilities are charging. And it will, though. And that's going to mitigate some of the inflationary pressures as well. Then, when we look at the agriculture prices, well, when energy prices come down, then the cost of producing agriculture improves. Now, corn broke lower 2 weeks ago, and then it was a bit firmer in here today, so it's still holding the sequence of higher reaction lows. And soybeans have also been weaker, but now it is the big decision point. It's right in the region of the 200-day moving average, and if the upward bias is going to be sustained, it's going to find support around 1400. Then there's a lot of concern about what's likely in the wheat market because of Russia's determination that they want to try and export their own wheat through the Black Sea. So the price there is steadying from an oversold condition and continuing to hold the upper side of that base formation, but this has been a very substantial breakdown. Now, we do have swine flu in China and bird flu in Europe, so it's quite possible that we're going to have some volatility or perhaps upward pressure in lean hogs over the course of the next couple of months. Prices jumped higher last week, gave up some of that in here this week, but did hold the breakout. So we are in an environment where there's a lot of volatility in commodity prices, but energy, and I did put in the wrong ticker there. This is the DB Agriculture Fund. It's pushed down through the 200-day moving average this week and looks susceptible to additional weakness as the global economy begins to slow down. So then there is the additional issue that governments are broke and they're running deficits. So there have to be some grown-up conversations about how to meet those deficits. Now, I think we have to give the benefit of at least give some praise to what they're attempting to do in France. Whether they're successful or not is going to be a very significant question. But they are trying to push through raising the retirement age from 62 to 64. Now, for everyone who's already dealing with retirement ages of 65 and plus, that doesn't sound like a lot, but it's obviously a big deal for French people. And lots of countries are going to have this discussion. And the quantity of cash that is sitting out in the that needs to be funded from the wider social security and the unfunded liabilities from Medicare. These are all, I think, very significant issues. So they're going to have to be that nettle would have to be grasped eventually. And it certainly would benefit those types of funds if asset prices were higher. So the easy answer would be to inflate their way into higher asset prices. I do think that's why gold is doing better, and I also think that's the primary reason why the dollar is starting to roll over here in the region of the 200-day moving average. And the big run-up in 2021 and 22 was about interest rate differentials, and I think that the rundown from those peaks is also about narrowing interest rate differentials because the EU is more likely to raise rates than the Federal Reserve is, and the interest rate differential has narrowed significantly over the last 6 months. And it is quite likely that the size of the Fed's balance sheet will continue to expand. They will continue to make money available to the banking sector. That doesn't mean that they're going to cut rates immediately, but it is likely that they are going to cut rates eventually. And we're going to see a much steeper yield curve. The most important thing is that they do have room to cut. Now, the one thing that's important to highlight is that when we go back and look at that yield curve spread, what we generally see is that when the yield curve spread is rising up through zero and through 50 basis points, that generally coincides with the worst performance in stocks because investors take fright at the possibility that there is going to be a deep recession, that the rate of bankruptcies is going to increase, that a lot of the leveraged plays are going to be heavily impacted, and that perhaps even property prices are going to roll over. Well, we're in a different type of environment this year because 2022 was a really negative year, even though we had a negative yield curve. And usually that's not the case. And we've seen a lot of selling pressure already in particularly the more over-levered portions of the market. And I think the ARK Innovation ETF is a good way of looking at that. One thing that I'm particularly aware of right now is that when we think about the question of whether they're going to just cut rates, abandon the quest to bring down inflation, and they're going to certainly be looking at, and it's the Fed's preferred gauge, they'll be looking at the PCE inflation, and it's around 4.7%. Well, with energy prices starting to come back down, and stocks rolling over, and banks rolling over, and less credit available, well, perhaps the inflationary measures might start to come back down. Now, when we look at the services inflation, well, then it's around 2.4%. And sorry, that has not updated since 2016. So let me make sure we have the right one. Now, this was the preferred gauge that Jerome Powell said he was looking at several meetings ago. Now, if they are going to look simply at services ex shelter and look at that on a 3-month annual basis, well, then they are going to be able to conclude that inflation has been conquered. And there's the potential that that's all they're looking for. So maybe they're going to say, well, this way of measuring inflation is good enough. Now, we're still at the end of December for this measure. So it's not going to be updated again until the end of the first quarter. But in the off chance that this comes in below zero, even though CPI inflation is high, they might just simply say, well, this is one of the measures we're paying particular attention to. And the fact that it has come in significantly, well, that's good enough. And if we just simply stop raising rates now and perhaps cut a little from here, then that's going to sustain the economic expansion. Of course, it also holds out the potential that inflationary pressures will ramp higher again. And certainly the home builders have popped on the upside in here this week. So any even mild whiff that bond yields are likely to come back down is certainly supporting the outlook for the housing sector and mortgages more generally. The thing that I've been most, I think, confident about over the last 3 or 4 months has been that yields are going to come back down because the quantitative tightening programs generally contribute to a big push higher in yields at the beginning and then contribute to a big collapse in yields at the end. And we're coming towards the end of the quantitative tightening programs. And that suggests that deflationary fears are going to rise and there will be demand for longer dated bonds. So the 10-year yield is now right in the region of the 200-day moving average. And if we see downside follow through next week, now I will be first to say that there is certainly a short-term overbought condition and we might see some additional wobble here because the Fed meeting isn't until Wednesday. But if it sustains the move down through that level next week, then it will have broken the consistency of the trend. Below 3%, it will trigger a midpoint danger line stop. And then there's the potential that yields could compress really quite significantly. But I suspect that the low will probably be somewhere around 2%. And one reason for that is if we look at the very long swing of total returns on a rolling 10-year Treasury future. Well, a move to about 2% would take it back into the region of the 5-year moving average. This was the most consistent trend in the world for decades. Then it accelerated, then it had experienced a deep decline between the end of 2020 and the end of 2022. We've had a good size rebound in here this week because the both the yield and the capital appreciation are in its favor. But if this is the end of the secular bull market in treasuries, then we're going to see resistance for this index being encountered somewhere in the region of that 1,000-day moving average. And it's not that difficult to think about why that might be the case. But that also brings to the fore the other big question. So we know that governments don't have cash. This is true for the UK, it's true for many of the European countries. And we know that banks are sitting on significant losses. Now, when we think about what's going on in Credit Suisse, what I think this really helps to highlight is that the majority of the negative yielding bonds were in Japan and in Europe, and they are experiencing the biggest stress right now. So Credit Suisse continues to trend lower. Now, the Swiss National Bank announced a 50 billion or 54 billion Swiss franc, or f I think it was 50 billion Swiss francs. Support in here this week, and that's going to support liquidity. It's not going to repair the business model of Credit Suisse, and it's certainly not helping in terms of confidence. But I don't think that the company is going to be allowed to go bust, but it will probably be bought out or split up, and it might be worth more split up than it is as a single unit. But it is just one of the banks that have been buying bonds. And Deutsche Bank, which is obviously state-owned or partially state-owned, is also breaking lower in here this week. It's also worth considering that there are only two listed German banks, and Commerzbank has pulled back in an exceptionally violent manner in here this week as well. So that does look like the end of that particular breakout. There was a lot of speculation about whether Standard Chartered is going to be bought out. Well, they might certainly benefit from waiting a while to see if they can get a better price. So we're certainly in a difficult environment, but the more likely scenario here is that there will be assistance in the form of monetary accommodation for the banking sector, because economies simply can't do without the banking sector. And that is not something that most regular voters like to hear, but there is going to be additional liquidity made available to assist the banking sector. And inflationary pressures will eventually moderate, but that doesn't mean that they're going to evaporate. And there's a lot of spending that is going to take place over the course of the next decade. There's going to be a huge increase in the quantity of social spending because of the baby boomer generation retiring. That means higher healthcare costs at the bare minimum, as well as higher social outlays. But then there's the additional question about the hegemony of the US dollar. So there's a war going on in Ukraine, which is basically between Russia and NATO, and they're lobbing their arsenals of material at one another. And the rate at which they're running down their arsenals greatly outstrips the ability to replace them. And Russia is basically making the bet that they can keep going longer than NATO can. And at that point, then the war will turn in their favor. So then NATO has the additional point that they're trying their best to increase their outlays. But then on the other side is China, which is sitting pretty with its arsenal both intact and increasing military spending. So when we think about what does China want? Well, what China wants is to be the global hegemon. And the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index has firmed this week from the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, this is not simply pricing in the outlays in terms of defense, but also in terms of duplication of manufacturing capacity. And the it's very emblematic of the trend towards friend-shoring and reshoring. And obviously, Taiwan is a very big chess piece for geopolitics. And in any potential outcome where that source of technology supply is curtailed or destroyed, well, then that's going to put a great deal of upward pressure on the price of technology components everywhere. So I believe that is why the SOX index is pushing higher from here. But then it's also responding to the volume of liquidity that is on the horizon. Now, Bitcoin has rallied significantly over the last week. So at the end of last week, it was testing 20,000, and this week it's closing out at 26,000. So this is a really significant breakout. And we are about 13 months out from the halvening. And when we look at what's happened in advance of other halvenings, well, the last halvening was in about May of 2020. And we can see then that a year before that, it bottomed. And we had a really significant rebound. So prices went from about 3,500 up to 13,000. So we get a 4x move, and then they came back down again. And it was ahead of the halvening that we had a big decline. Then let's just remember as well that we had a big run up in 2014, we had a big run up in 2017, and in between those periods, you get really significant declines. We had a big run up in 2011 and a big run down, and then a subsequent run up, but there's a good 2 to 3 year gap between the peaks. Now, as we look then at what is the potential here? Well, I suspect that if the pattern is going to hold true, then we should have a good sized rebound in Bitcoin now, and it could take the price up to about 50,000. And then over the course of the balance of the year, that prices could deteriorate again, and then subsequently rally after the halvening in April. But the other big important point is that the really big moves in Bitcoin, whether that is in the latter part of 2017 or in the latter part of 2020, all the way up to the peak in 2021, they've coincided with episodes of massive monetary or fiscal accommodation. So in 2017, it was the Trump tax cuts, and in 2020, it was money printing on a global scale. So the big pop on the upside in here is both in recognition of the fact that prices are a lot lower than they were a year and a half ago, but also a bet that, or it's basically buying an option that what we're going to have is a massive episode of money printing. And that is also why gold is pushing up to its all-time highs right now. From a stock market perspective, I think it is particularly relevant here that it is Bitcoin miners are those that are doing best. So if we look at, for example, one that's reasonably well known, which is Riot, then it has popped on the upside right along with gold, with Bitcoin. And even then, it is still in the region of its base formation. So there is obviously the potential here for a rebound as investors begin to position themselves for an asset that is reasonably well uncorrelated with the economy, but highly correlated with liquidity. And that's why I have constantly referred to Bitcoin as a liquidity barometer. So that tells us then how people are positioning themselves. They're positioning for weakness in the banking sector, uncertainty in several other sectors, particularly anything to do with the consumer, but also pricing in the potential that yields are going to come back down, that the yield curve is going to go from inverted to positive. So when we think about the the steepening of the yield curve. There are ETFs that give access to that. And that means that banks will be bailed out via the yield curve, which also suggests that once this period of weakness has ended, there are going to be really attractive buying opportunities within the banking sector. Now, the big question in terms of spending and priorities is going to continue to focus on renewable energy. Now, copper prices broke downwards in here this week. They have not yet broken down through a midpoint danger line, but they are right in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. If the price is going to hold, it needs to rally next week. And that is going to be very dependent on what happens with China. But at least it is holding up better than oil prices. When we think about the renewable energy sector, there is a lot of money flowing into it. We've had the Inflation Reduction Act in the USA, and then China has had its own focus on building out renewable infrastructure. And the EU is now getting in on that act. And Germany is talking with its largest coal mine, for example, about it ceasing activities 5 years early. Now, obviously, the coal miner is not particularly happy with that, and most particularly the coal workers are not going to be happy with that. But it does give us an indication of where the direction of conversations is going. So, you have companies like Volkswagen announcing just this week that they're going to have a 25,000 euro compact car that will be ready for mass production in 2025. Now, there's a lot of people, I think, particularly the fans of Tesla, probably don't really believe that they're going to do that. But they're also talking about cutting prices in China, and they're going to start investing in mining. Personally, I think all of that sounds really expensive, and the share was down in a really dynamic manner in here today. But inside the, when we think about the internal dynamics of the range, the size of the downward dynamics is much larger than the upward dynamics, and it suggests that we're going to see lower levels overall. But what that also suggests is that the demand that the automotive sector has experienced over the last 2 years is probably not going to last, and the share price already represents that, or I think reflects that. So we are still in an environment where we're going to have there is a recession on the horizon. There will be greater monetary accommodation. Cash is not a bad place to be right now. There will be wonderful buying opportunities because central banks will likely do what is necessary to avoid deep recessions. But then the bigger question is, how long is that monetary accommodation going to stay in the market for? Now, when we look at the performance of the Nasdaq relative to gold, then it's right in the region of the big decision point. If the gold price outperforms, then this ratio is going to drop down through six, and it's already below the 1,000-day moving average. What that suggests to me is that we're going to have a physical resources bull market. So there will be demand for precious metals like gold, and there will be demand for renewable energy resources like copper, but it's going to be jumpy in the early stages because there's still a lot of demand for oil, and you have companies that are reluctant to increase investment in oil, so then that's going to curtail supply. And the longer that goes on for, then the more of a supply inelasticity means rising demand environment you're going to have. But oil prices depend on steady demand, and demand is not going to be steady in a recessionary environment. Now, when we think about the global economy, well, if reshoring is going to benefit anyone, then Mexico is likely to benefit. But the ETF now is pulling back down into the underlying range. So it's likely to be a better buy following a pullback. And then at Fortescue Metals, for example, was in positive territory today, but it is pulling back down into this underlying range. When we think about the global fertilizer sector, well, it would be easy to think that we're going to have legions of new consumers and they all need to be fed, and at least another billion people in the world over the next decade. But we've had a really significant pullback in Mosaic, for example, this week. And it suggests that commodity prices are probably going to come down before they recover. So I suspect that what we're going to have first is a deflationary shock, but then subsequently there will be an inflationary shock in response to the big surge in liquidity. And that will then lead to shorter cycles. So we're not going to have the big bull market that lasts a decade, like we had in the aftermath of the 2008 crisis. And I guess that did last until 2021, so it's more like a 14-year bull market. I think that it's much more likely because of the threat of inflation and the need to inflate the debts away, that what we're going to have instead will be shorter, sharper cycles. So we'll go up for a couple of years, down for 18 months, and up for a couple of years. And that's going to be very similar to what happened in the 1970s, where we had a great deal of volatility in asset prices. And then we are going to have a difficult decade in terms of geopolitics, because China's demographics are not favorable. If they're going to make their play for global hegemony, then they basically have a decade in which to do it. And after that, then they're not going to have the swell of young people to fuel that kind of advance without taking a big economic hit. So it does suggest that the arsenal advantage that they will have in the aftermath of the Ukraine war is something that they're unlikely to waste. And they're definitely becoming much more active in courting the global south. So countries like Nigeria are going to be very pivotal in that kind of environment. So this is a local currency ETF, or excuse me, index. If we rebase that into dollars, well, then we're going to get a different picture. But it does look like a base formation. And Nigeria is both an oil producer and the largest population country in Africa. And the billion people born over the course of the next decade, well, a lot of them are going to be from Africa. And Africa has a new continent-wide free trade zone. So that's also likely to fuel economic activity. Then India has universally been best bought following reactions and significant reactions. So this is still the US dollar redenominated chart of India. In local currency terms, it's still a lot closer to the peak, but it has pulled back down through the 200-day moving average. And I suspect that we will see additional weakness here, that India is a lot more interconnected globally than it used to be. And that would make it more susceptible than it has been in the past to global activity. And then I think it's particularly relevant to highlight that the Chinese market is still steadying, but it's not firing on the upside. So economic activity has not bounced back in nearly the same way as it has in the West following the removal of their pandemic restrictions. And it's been a difficult market to make money in for most of the last decade. But at least it is steadying here. But then the weakness of the dollar will also help to support prices in Hong Kong. And of course, the H share index is a Hong Kong index. When we think about the broader metals sector, I mean, there was news today that the LME might not have as much nickel as they require or is backed up by their contracts. And the nickel price didn't really move on the back of that. And instead, the LME metals index is pulling back down through the 200-day moving average. So I think that there's certainly the potential here that returns in the near term are going to be focused or concentrated within the gold sector and precious metals more generally, and within the cryptocurrencies. And the gold miners popped on the upside in here today to confirm support around the $30 level. And this continues to look like support building. And if gold prices pop up through $2,000 and oil prices continue lower, well, then that is going to significantly enhance the margins of gold miners. So they have the potential to play catch up, which I suspect is more likely than not. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.